Spectacular Diagnostics.
Hello and welcome back to Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. Today's podcast is called The Art of the Sprint Train. I am joined by none other than Greg Henderson, possibly the best lead-out man of all time, and we are going to take apart the sprint train and bring you everything you ever wanted to know about it. Greg Henderson, former track world champion, won the Scratch Race in 2004. He's appeared in 5 Olympic Games, 4 Commonwealth Games. He's had a hugely successful race career, riding for T-Mobile, Columbia, Sky, Lotto. He's won 2 stages in Paris, and he's won 1 stage in the Vuelta. Greg, does that just about sum up your career?
Yeah, I guess it does. It's such a bloody long career. It's hard to remember when you were good and when you were bad. Oh, no, you can always remember when you were bad, but it's the good that's pretty far and few between.
Now, if we go back to 2010, you joined Team Sky. You were there from the start, and you were there for 2 years, riding for your own results, and you achieved some notable successes. Then in 2012, you got the call to go and join Lotto with Andre Greipel, but to ride as a lead-out man and not chase your own results. Was that an easy decision to make?
Absolutely, a natural progression. I'd been told I was selected for the tour for 2 years on Sky, and then they obviously focused on GC, and I mean, that was obviously a silly decision by them, because what have they done on GC recently? But so that was like, right, if I'm going to get to the tour, I'm not going to be on this team. And I'd been speaking with Greipel. We'd been good mates for a long time. And the other thing I looked at, you know, I'm a realistic kind of guy too, down to earth. And I was like, well, if I come up in a sprint against Cavendish, Kittel and Greipel, and I have my best sprint and they have their best sprint, I'm still going to get fourth. And you don't get paid for fourth place as a sprinter. So I said, right, I know what I am good at, and I know what Greipel's missing. So I think between the two of us, we can actually be quite dangerous.
Cycling is it's kind of a different sport. Guys who are on the same team live hundreds of miles away from each other and don't often get a chance to actually practice together. Now, I remember Australia at the start of each year used to be video footage of you guys training as a sprint train. How much training did you actually get to do with the sprint train?
So the thing with a sprint train is every rider has a different power phase, let's call it, and a different length of time in which they're actually on the front pulling the train. So you could train that distance, you could train that time, you could train that power on your own. I mean, we used to come together before Tour of Belgium before, and then we'd always make sure that we did, what did we do? Luxembourg, we did Star Electro Tour. We did 3 in Tour of Belgium, I think it was, before the Tour de France. So we had 3 opportunities as a team to ride together. But when you train in a sprint train out on the road, you just can't replicate what happens in a race, because you know sometimes you're too early at the front, sometimes you're too late, sometimes you're getting squeezed on the barriers waiting for the corner to open. You know, there's so many variables in a race that you have to know and learn on the fly, whereas when you train it as a team, yeah, it's great because you get a massive capacity workout, you get a massive lactate workout, as everyone has their meter markers, everyone sprints for the amount of time that they're supposed to and deliver the sprinter to the final 200 meters. But to actually replicate that as a training exercise, to replicate a sprint in a race is nearly impossible.
Before each sprint stage, what was the level of preparation like?
Yeah, I was a bit of a stickler for the details. I'd be on the Google Maps. I would be, obviously, first thing is you look at the race book. Often we were quite lucky with, Tour of Belgium or Luxembourg, we'd done those finishes probably 4 or 5 times, so they were the same. It was more of like which direction's the wind coming from this year. But when it came to the tour, it would be Google Maps. You'd have to have even the first couple of two or three stages, we could actually recon the finishes because we'd be there early enough. We'd go and see the finishes to make sure we knew exactly what side of the roundabout to take, which side's shorter, are we sprinting on the left or the right, what's the predominant wind. So all those sort of things actually do make a large difference. I mean, there's sometimes you'll see us taking the long way around a corner, a sweeping right hand, but that's because the wind's coming from the right and we have to protect against the barrier. If we take the shortest way and we go hard against the right-hand barrier instead of the left-hand barrier, we give everyone shelter. So there's things like that that just, you know, it's pretty hard to see on TV where the wind's coming from exactly, but you can feel it obviously when you're out there. So there's definitely, the detail is very important. Is it a headwind? Is it slightly uphill? Is it slightly downhill? You know, that can extend or shorten up how far you can actually sprint. Yeah, there's a lot of things that that you used to take into consideration. And then there's also that one factor that that I used to, I think I got it from probably a lot of my track racing days, was just that feel of when to go, when to wait, what side of the road to be on. And I just never, ever panicked. I was never that stressful guy calling the shots. I was always very, very relaxed and yes, no, wait, you know, things like that were just come out of my mouth nice and calm, and it kept the whole team calm, and most importantly, it kept Greifel calm.
For me, that's what splits an average lead out man and a brilliant lead out man. Do you think, coming from the track, you ex-track riders have an advantage over the others?
I really believe we do, yes. Because obviously, okay, for starters, the track racing, there's no brakes, so you can't make abrupt decisions. You've got to know the easiest way. You've got to know when the gaps are going to open, and it just, I think it just it really transcribes beautifully across to road racing and finding yourself at the front without expending a lot of energy. That's the key. Everyone can get to the front, but they arrive in various shapes and form, you know, like how much energy they've used. So and then it got to the point where Greipel was so comfortable on my wheel, and I knew if I went through a gap that it might be too small for him. I knew instantly to have a look around and wait to make sure he was there. And he became so comfortable with that he wouldn't even have to. He wouldn't even think about the final. I would write the plan out the night before and send it to the group WhatsApp. And Greipel was like, "Brilliant! I don't think I just follow, mate." So that's to the level of understanding and confidence we had in each other.
After a race, particularly if something's gone wrong, how honest were those conversations? Did they ever get heated? Were they brutally honest?
Yeah, 100%. Yep, there's no question. And to be fair, like, you know, I've been on the bus and, you know, of course, everyone's pissed off because something didn't quite go right. But, you know, I remember sitting down with the guys once and going, "Guys, look, we didn't do this on purpose, okay? It was a mistake. Like, it's not like we went out there and tried to sacrifice a result today. So yes, I understand everyone's upset with the result, but let's learn from it. We made a mistake, like, and yes, okay, we were missing one guy on the lead out, but we won't be missing it next time. So it's not like he did it on purpose, because it was usually the tempers flared when someone wasn't doing their job, and when they weren't doing their job, that basically means they weren't there when we needed to go at 2Ks. So, you know, then we have to wait to 1.5K, and then there's a chance we get swamped or something like that, you know. If we ever got beaten in a sprint and we did nothing wrong, it was just straight up grunt. It's like, what can you do? You can't win every bike race. It's impossible to win every bike race, and we knew that. We're old enough and silly enough to know that, so that was never really an issue. It was just whether someone wasn't doing their job. And, you know, again, when we had that much trust in each other and that much confidence, you know, the train basically from Zeeburg to Yogi to myself to Greipel, it was like this group of four that when we took off at about 1,200 metres, 1,400 metres, it was just, there wasn't too many trains as fast as us over that last K and a half, so to speak.
At Lotto, you developed this sprint train, this legendary sprint train. So we had Marcel Seeberg, Jürgen Rollins, or Yogi, yourself, and André Greipel. And before that, depending on the day, a Lars Bak or an Adam Hansen. There was a spell in 2014, 2015 where you guys were basically untouchable. How did it feel to work in this group?
Yeah, and it was, again, we picked the attributes of each other. You know, like Seberg has got an amazing 30-second power and he gives a good set, obviously. Jürgen Rollins, like we had a discussion one time, and I'm brutally honest with him, and I just said, mate, I'm not faster than you. Don't think that for 1 second. I don't go around thinking I'm faster than you. But you're stronger than me, and if I need you to go an extra 50 metres, you can do it. I said, I know I can do 300 metres, and that's it. I'm gassed. I'm done. Whereas you, if you need to go an extra 50, I can ask you to do it, and you'll do it. And then Greipel can hear me a lot easier from if I'm sitting at the back. And, you know, it's just that lovely honesty that we had. And I just knew, and so reliable. I knew Seberg would give me 500 metres. I knew that Yogi would give me 300, 350. I knew I could do 300. So it was like, and then you knew, there was just never any hesitation that Greipel would come down the inside of you at 200 metres to go. It was. We got so drilled at it, mate, that you've seen a few photos, but I knew when to throw my hands in the air, the speed he would come past me compared to the other bike riders. It would just be night and day. He'd just like, well, there's no way anyone's going to come close to that because he's going 3K an hour faster than them. So one of the best ones, my favourite one, was our first Tour de France stage we won. Greipel's gone past. He's still sprinting to the line, and I've got my hands in the air, and then I think Jürgen sees my hands in the air, so his go up. If you look further down, Seberg's got his hands in the air, and Greipel's still sprinting.
Now, you talked a little bit there about markers. No, in a normal sprint stage, flat sprint stage, the four guys in the train, what sort of markers were they riding to?
So we would get either, like you said, Buck or Hansen. Hansen was pretty good if he was there. He could go at about 1,600, 1,700 metres, like just after the 2K to go sign, basically. And then Seberg, when Seberg could look up, he would see the red kite. So when he could see it, he must be at about 1,100, 1,150. That's when he would go. And that's when no one moved, basically, from that point on. It was just get as small as you can, get as aerodynamic as you can, and hold on, because it just gets faster and faster. And then he would take Yogi right to about 800, 850. And Yogi would go, and it would be like, yeah, this nice smooth acceleration, because we had to practice that. That was one of the other things. I'll go into that later. But so at 800 metres, he would go, and it would just be this beautiful acceleration for 300 metres. And he'd drop me off at 500. And then I knew I had 300 metres in my legs. And then and it was just a natural progression, because I explained it to them like a teen's pursuit. It's about delivery speed. So if you can drop the person off at the same speed or faster than you've been delivered, then the actual knock-on effect is an extra 2 or 3 k's an hour. So it would be, you know, on any day, it would be 66 from Seberg, 68 from Yogi, 70 from me, and then Greipel would be doing 73, 74. He would always lift that 3 or 4 k an hour, not 2 k an hour. But the other thing I had to learn to do, when I first went across, I still had quite a good sprinting capacity or sprinting ability. So I had to really calm down my jump, and I ended up calling myself like a 30-second time trialist. I didn't even end up calling myself a sprinter in the end, because my maximum power was 1,200 watts, and then I think I would deliver them at 1,000 or 1,050, you know, like my actual my power curve was just like a straight line, basically. So, and I had to do it out of my seat too. I had to change that because I was too small seated for Greipel to get a sit. So I had to learn to do the 300 meters, the whole thing out of the seat, so he could get a sit. So it's just those small variations, those small changes, just to make things absolutely perfect. And yeah, like you said, there was a time there where we were so dominant. We'd found what worked for us. A lot of teams started to try and copy it, but still didn't have, you know, the what side of the road to be on, or how to protect your side of the road. And so it was it was really some good times back then.
Some people think that being a lead-out man's about sprinting as fast as you can for as long as you can, but it's not like that at all, is it?
No, it's a smooth delivery of power, correct, because you have to drop them off. There's no use smashing it for 10 seconds and then just dying. And then, you know, you might hit 68, 70 and then drop them off at 68 or 65, you know. There's nothing worse than that because then he has to obviously pick the speed up. It's too much work for him. So you have to hold and then deliver more than what you've been given. And that's where we had that really nice progression of the three or four of us before Greipel.
Upon days when things didn't go exactly to plan, say you're stuck on the front for a long time towards the end of the sprint, how would you adapt your plans?
Well, I was actually quite good. I was quite cunning on the bike. And I used to trick guys into helping us out, and I remember the French were the easiest, you know, because they'd just send one guy to do a flyer and he's thinking he's helping his sprinter out. So I'd bring, if I knew we were coming up short, I'd invite him in. Good, you know, like, and he'd be like, oh yeah, great. And he'd just do this burner for us and I'd be like, oh great, that gave us another 200 meters. So there wasn't too many times where it got messed up. There's been the odd time where it might be Greipel and I left for whatever reason, a crash, or maybe Greipel and I were the only ones sent to the race for whatever reason. And it's been a few times where I've been on the front and I've had to tell him, like, give a signal, mate, drop back a couple of wheels, because I'll go now, because otherwise we're going to get swamped. But if you go back behind a couple of sprinters, and I'll swing off at, say, 500, because if you swing off at 500, they kind of have to go. They can't. It's too close to the finish to wait for someone, but it's too far out to actually win from there. So it's a really awkward stage. 500, 400, and it was just me being a pain in the ass, really, because that's the worst place to drop someone off, is at that range. They have to go, and then you know it's perfect because they've gone way too early for Greipel, and Greipel can just step off the wheel.
An uphill sprint. How does that change things in terms of your markers?
Yeah, definitely. That it shortens it right up. It's you know, it has to be uphill. You know, when you say uphill, I'm probably talking maximum 5% gradient for not too long. Yeah, we had this. I remember one stage in the tour, Yogi took off up the climb. I was on his wheel. Greipel was on mine. And Yogi went so hard. I just remember it was like slow motion, and his back wheel was just inching away from my front wheel, and there was just nothing I could do about it. I was just 100% maxed out, and then he swung off it. He got me closer. He got me to 400, but it's still uphill, and I went, and I couldn't go any faster, and then all of a sudden, I think it was Brett Lancaster came flying down the outside, and Greipel, he just goes plop onto the back of, it was Gossie at the time, on the back of Gossie, looks around and then goes, bang, just smashes it, wins by them in, I don't know, four lengths or something. It's crazy. I was like, I was just absolutely cooked. And he's just sitting there picking his nose, waiting for the sprint.
Greipel wasn't always such a fan of these technical sprint finish. So one that's got maybe four or five tight 90-degree corners in the last 3K. How would you adapt things in that type of finish?
Well, I used to really like that because I would always tell you can adapt from the front there. You can take the front a lot easier because when you get to the corners, I don't know if you remember the stage in the Giro 2015, maybe I did it with Greipel and I had Lars back and Adam Hansen. That was the only train we had. And I said, we were going exact same thing, corners left and right and left and right. And I'm screaming at Lars, if we hit the corner first, you just slow right down and then you just accelerate nice and gently. So it just extends your lead out an extra 300 or 400 meters because you can dictate the exact speed everyone goes through that corner. You don't have to go through full gas. No one's going to pass you. And as long as you're accelerating, they're not going to come past you because you're accelerating and it's going to cost them too much energy. And then you hit the next corner, so you slow down and I fan out and then Greipel fans out, so there's no actual room around the corner. And then you go in slow, you come out slow. So if it's really technical and you're at the front, you dictate the speed. It's all yours. And then, you know, once you get through the technical stuff, you can then start your lead out good and proper. So it can be advantageous to have it technical as long as you're at the front. You've got a Lars back who can hit it from 3K out and pull the team to the front that far out. and then you can control. If you haven't got that type of guy, then yeah, you might be in trouble and you're going to be stuck and you're going to have to wait till you've exited the corners to have a crack at the lead out.
It's actually one of my favourite ever finishes. The 2015 Giro, stage 6. You guys hit the front with just about 3k to go because you're coming into a technical section with like three 90-degree corners. There was Lars Bak, there was Adam Hansen, but because there was only a couple of yous, it looked like you were running out of men. And then I think inside the last kilometre, it was maybe a Trek rider came in and did a turn, and then it was you, and then you released Andre for what was a brilliant win. What do you remember about that day?
So I was on the radio making sure it was a tailwind, and I double-checked. I asked like three times, are you sure it's tailwind in the final? Yes, tailwind. I was like, okay, good. I know I can go from 600. And then it was actually Ferrari, I think, from Lamprey that came and joined in. And he gave us like 300 or 400 meters flat stick. It was awesome. And then Adam had to go. And obviously, that's not the place for Adam. It's too close to the final. And I'm screaming at him, come on, mate, go. We've got to go faster. But I was clever enough. It's like track sprinting. You leave a bike length or something. So that if someone does come past you, you don't get swamped. You can run at the wheel and move your way out. So I'd left about a bike length to Hansen just in case someone came. And then there was one trek rider came, and I went then onto his wheel, straight past him, and then I knew that was 600 to go. I knew I could get to 200 from there in the tailwind. And, yeah, it was just so fast, that last 400 metres.
Talking of memorable moments, I'll take you back to 2015 Paris-Nice Stage 3 and a monster lead out by you. Do you remember that day?
Yeah. It's funny, that this is a funny story about this one, is that the next day, Greipel come up to me and he goes, bloody hell, Henderson, I've had more people ask about how strong you were yesterday than I had winning. But yeah, no, it was just one of those days. And obviously Paris-Nice, it's bizarre. I don't know how to explain this, but Paris-Nice, I am always flying. I don't know whether it's the summer that I had in Australia that then, you know, and then you do a nice block in Europe and you're actually just hitting really good form in Paris-Nice. But as you said, I'd won two stages there before and I just seem to be in great nick when it comes to Paris-Nice. So again, I was in great nick. I was feeling amazing all day. It was Mitch Docker came around me with leading out Michael Matthews, and it was the South African, Daryl Impey, first. And I left Zeebe straight away, and you know, he wasn't ready to be left, but I just knew we were getting close enough to the finish that he didn't have time to do his pull anymore. So I used up Docker, and I looked back, and I saw Chavanel coming with DeMar. And I thought, right, now's the time. And it was just before 500, but the thing was, it was a headwind. And, I just had a really good sprint. I got him inside 200 in the headwind. And, as you can see, it was just single file the whole, like, as soon as we turned that last corner, it was just one line. Nobody could move. When I took off, even Greipel said he had problems holding the wheel. So, yeah, it was definitely one of my best ones.
In the first stage win in the Tour, we've talked about brilliant stages from the Giro and Paris-Nice. Is there any other lead out that really sticks in your mind?
When we first, our very first race together was Tour Down Under Classic. It was just nice. I was a bit nervous. We'd come together. We'd done a few sprint trains and then we won. You know, it's just the opening crit, but it's the very first sign. It's the very first indication of how the team's going to go. And I earned a lot of trust from the guys there because I told them, I said, Zeeberg, you're going to be racing Matt Heyman down this straight here, okay? Like, I knew exactly who it would be from Sky that we're racing. I said, then we're going to turn the corner. We've got to go first. Out of there, it's going to break when we go out of the corner. Like, the peloton will snap. And then when we did the lead out, like, it was just, you know, always look behind. I remember I used to look under my legs to make sure before I took off. I'd just make sure I saw Greipel's white Garnets. Like, righto, he's on the wheel. Away we go. And it was, that was just a really nice feeling. Like, okay, this is going to work well. And everybody was as happy as Greipel was for the win, you know? And then it just flowed so nicely from there.
Now, we've discussed this beautiful long sprint train that you guys had at Lotto, which dominated for many years. Now, things have kind of changed. And looking at recent trains in cycling and sprinting in particular, the short train is now becoming more popular. What do you think about that?
I think it's something to do with, you know, those GC riders and their trains, they're so strong. Like, we used to always have to fight them up to about 3 kilometres to go. So now they've gone in with like a sniper train, you know. They've gone, right, let's let them do the three up to 3K. We can surf around there. They still want to stay out of trouble, so it's going to be fast enough. And then when we go, it's going to be flat stick and nobody can move. It's not that progression. So it's like the two guys in front of them are almost sprinters. You know, there might be one dedicated lead out guy, but he's typically a sprinter himself and could win stages. He's not like what I called myself as the time trialist, you know, 30-second time trial. He's actually really, really punchy. And yeah, what I've noticed about the sprinting recently is there's so many guys that can win. It's not, you know, how many times you put money on, if Lotto turned up with Greipel, you'd good chance that they were going to dominate the sprint. Or there might be one or two guys that may beat him. But now you're like, it's a lucky dip who's going to, I mean, yeah, like Viviani, I expected, you know, Sam Bennett's been flying, and then Viviani, and I mean, it was a beautiful lead out for the London race. I mean, that was textbook. That was nice to see. But I was just thinking, in the old days, mate, I could never ever get inside 300 metres before I opened my sprint. You know, so whoever's delivered Markov has done an exceptional job.
Quickstep really have become the masters at this late surge. In particular, when Markov usually rides in position number 3, he just kind of sits and waits around, and then inside that final kilometre, bam, they go. And quite often, they win from there. They're almost unstoppable when he gets it right.
It's true, isn't it? The only chance you've got is having Viviani's wheel and just pipping him on the line, like going sprinter mano a mano. That's the only chance you've got. You've got no chance of getting your train up beside him. And that's, again, like, as we spoke about, that's a good old-fashioned track rider, mate. He's got that many smarts on the track. He's Madison world champion. It's that ability to sit there, sit at high power for a long time as well, before opening, and not to panic and to be able to see where it's going to open. Okay, the corners, we're going around left here, so on the right is going to open. You know it is, because the natural tendency of a bunch is to around the left-hand corners to merge left. So you know, right, I can smack it on the right soon. Just those little things that you learn. And yeah, don't panic. That's the major, major thing. It's like I used to always say to Greipel, was like, mate, if I can't get you to first place at 200 metres to go, I'll put you in a position where you can sprint from it. Like, I can actually get to that position 100% of the time. I'll get to a position where you can sprint from, if not first position. And it's true. Like, I can always get myself in the right position. You know, okay, it's not my job to sprint, so I arrive with dead legs at 200. But if he's on my wheel, he's in a position to win from there. And he might be at third wheel or fourth at the worst, but he can still win from that situation. And I think that's the other thing that's happening nowadays. If you can look after your sprinter as much as possible, if he arrives at 200 with as fresh a legs as possible, then it's, you know, he has got a chance of the victory.
Back a couple of years and look at the 2017 Tour de France, Quickstep again were doing things totally different because they had Marcel Kittel, who wasn't really keen on getting involved in the shoulder barging of the sprint finishes, and it seemed like they were just happy to drop him off at kind of 10th place, and then boom, he would go and win.
Are there any other leadouts that stick out in your mind?
Unbelievable, wasn't it? Yeah, he just had... And Greipel was actually really scared of him. You know, he's always, oh, what's Kittel doing? What's Kittel? And it's like, mate, we can't control what Kittel's doing. It's like, but how's he doing this coming from 10 back, you know? And like, I'd be like, oh, yeah, he's got the slipstream. He's got, don't worry about it. That's what happens. And then like, deep down, you're like, holy shit, this man's fast.
How would you have coped being Kittel's lead-out man? He almost makes your role redundant.
Yeah, I don't know if he would, though, to be honest. Like, we had enough respect for each other, you know, and he knew I was good at my job. I think I would have talked to him and, you know, come on, mate, we'll do it the easy way. We'll do it here. I don't know if he would, like, make me redundant like that, you know. But yeah, like, no, I'm just trying to think, would I even go, oh, okay, you're fine, you got it from here. But no, I don't think you would, because you really, you know, you build a relationship with your sprinter. So you really want to see them achieve, and you want to do everything you can to help them. So it's like, I mean, if that's what he really wanted, and like this is how he just, I mean, you would just do everything you could to make sure he arrived at 1K as fresh as he wanted and without having to fight. You know, he could just do whatever he had to do to get there. But yeah, like, it was just amazing. I remember, what was that stage in the Giro, I think he won, and what did he, must have come from 20 back or something stupid, and then he was so dead on the line, and that guy, that little young fella, got the selfie with him. Do you remember that?
I think when the Giro started in Ireland, I think that was maybe the Dublin stage.
Yes, yes, it was, yeah. And he just came from nowhere, mate. It was like, because I remember Swifty was nearly going to win the stage, and like, on any other day, Swifty had won a stage at the Giro, but this freak of nature just came from, you know, came from nowhere and just got him on the line. It was like, oh god,
the dark arts of the sprint train. You know, there are some lead out men who would deliberately swing off and block the path of a rival sprinter.
Well, there's a few tricks of the trade, isn't there? You know, you've got to be a little bit clever how you do it too. I mean, obviously I would never employ any of these techniques or anything, but you know, there's obviously, I would always leave a lane only one bike length wide so that only Greipel could come down there, and it would tempt other people to come down, but they just know, don't sprint down the barriers. If only Greipel, you're going to have to go around Henderson, because he's just going to look, if I'm sprinting down the right barrier, I'm going to look to the left and just close that door on the barrier. So that's a little trick you can do. You just can't, I mean, you don't do it maliciously either. Like, let's be honest, you don't. It's just one of those things, like, you have to, I don't want to crash either. If I'm coming back at, and you guys are coming forward at 70k an hour, it's like, I am holding my line, I'm not moving, because I do not want, and it's actually safer on the barrier, because you know they're going to go around you if you're on the barrier. And the only other thing I used to do was, like, that one I told you, was like, you'd get in front of another sprinter and you'd open the sprint, so he had to hold your wheel, and then you would swing off at an uncomfortable distance from the line, where it just put the sprinter in this really awkward position where he has to go, because otherwise he's going to get last, or yeah, so when he opens, and then, you know, he might hold on for fourth or fifth or whatever, but he's basically just given your sprinter a lead out. That's the only real tricks, you know, and there's no, I wouldn't say there's anything malicious in it at all. It's just a couple of little subtleties that can maybe give your sprinter an extra bike length, and that's it.
What about headbutts and shoulder charges? Have you ever employed a cheeky headbutt?
Because I came from the track, I mean, that was just common. I mean, that's how you used to get out. If you do those missing outs, those eliminations, that was the only way to move someone, is you had to lean on them and force your way out. So it just becomes second nature. And but yeah, it looks worse than it is. Like, it looks terrible. You see people headbutting. It's actually just a tap, and it's just a movement straight away. It's not even as dangerous as it looks, but it looks terrible. I'll give 100%. Like, when I see it on the TV, it's like, I know what they're doing, but it just doesn't look good. And now you've got to, you know, the bigger the race you go to, the cleaner you've got to ride. You've got to hold a straight line. Everything has to be 100%. I remember I got a warning. I was dodging Baden Cook. I was dodging a crash, and I got a warning for not riding a straight line. You know, you get two warnings and you're gone. I'm like, that's unbelievable. Like, I was literally avoiding a crash, and I got told off at the Tour de France. So the higher up the racing goes, the more, and, you know, it's in front of TVs, everyone's watching, millions of people are watching, I can understand it all. And, it, you know, Julian Dean and Renshaw, you know, it looked worse than what it was. Those two guys would have thought absolutely nothing of it at the time. It's, but yeah, if you've got millions of spectators, and a lot of them aren't bike riders, they don't know what's going on.
And I suppose the master of the shoulder charge these days is Peter Sagan. I don't know if you saw it, but it was in the Tour de Suisse. There was an uphill sprint on cobbles with a corner quite close to the end, and Sagan, surfing the wheels as usual, doesn't have a sprint train, and Trek come to the front, perfect timing, Stuyven and Degenkolb, and Sagan just decides he wants Stuyven's wheel, so boom, shoulder charge on Degenkolb, and he's right in there. I suppose he's a kind of different level in terms of his bike handling skills in those situations and decision making. What do you think?
He is. He's really got that, that really quick response. That it's like that type of guy where he hasn't crashed until he's actually lying on the ground. You know, he's still got a chance, even when he's horizontal and it doesn't. He's got 2 feet clicked out. He still hasn't crashed until he's hit the ground. So yeah, he's just got a great feel for the peloton, and you know, now he can, he sort of gets the rule of the roost too. You know, no one's actually going to give him too much opposition to fight for a wheel. He does do a few cheeky things, you know. I remember Cancellara used to do a similar sort of thing to get through. He'd be in the classics, he'd ride his handlebars into your bum, and then you'd look around and he'd go, oh, sorry, sorry, and then as he's saying sorry, ride past you. So he's just made a move to get, and of course it's Cancellara, like, oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, I'll get out the way, no worries. And I'd go through a whole peloton riding his handlebars into the backside of people. And then they would look around. As they're looking around, he's apologising and passing them. So, yeah, it's all these little tricks of the trade that they have, and it works well for them.
Did you ever have to take on the responsibility of trying to train up some of the new guys who were coming through? Obviously, the team realised you were a certain age, you were going to move on. Did you take that chance to help work with guys like Jasper de Boist and help share your experience?
Yes, absolutely. First, it was Jens de Boscher. He started coming in place of Yogi. And then Jasper, he was a good track rider as well. So we got on quite well. I remember way back in the day, his father was the Soignier for years. He told me that he was riding track and he wanted an Avanti bike from New Zealand and his young son. So I've got a bit of a relationship with Jasper, actually. And yeah, and then I think one of the last races I remember doing with him was maybe Star Electro. Oh, I can't remember what it was. Anyway, he was doing some lead. Well, we were going for the overall GC with Greipel. So we must have been going for intermediate sprints. And he was doing these lead outs with me on the wheel and Greipel. And it was like, oh, wow, that's that real track power there. Yeah, he's got some goods. He's going to be pretty good in the end.
A team were looking to improve their sprint training and get better. What would your advice be?
Unfortunately, with sprinting, it is experience. Like, you have to do time and time again. And one of the things I would tell a sprinter, wanting to be a sprinter, is there's that many negative thoughts, there's that many doubts in your head when you're leading into a sprint and then the team's all trying to get round you to help you. Have a go. Like, you have to lose before you know how to win. You have to, you're going to feel horrible most sprints you do, but you're still a sprinter. You still have 15 seconds of raw power. Doesn't matter how tired you are, but don't be afraid to fail. Like, that fear of not getting there or getting the wrong run. You have to go in that wrong place to know, okay, that's the wrong place to go. I should have gone to the right there and just opened and see what happens. And that's what you have to do sometimes. When I remember I was chatting with Tyler Farrar in a year where he just had a lot of crashes and he just lost all his confidence. And I said, mate, I'll give you a tip here, mate. Like, just pull out to the other side of the road and just open, like, even if you're open at 400 meters, and just test your speed against the guys. So it'll give you that confidence back. That's what he needed, was to see, okay, I'm still fast. And he tried it in one of the stages later on, and he came back to me and said, oh, Hendy, that was so good. I got up to level pegging, you know, first, and then obviously I opened at 100 meters before everyone else, so I died, and I think I finished 7th. I was like, there you go. So your speed is there. You're as fast as anyone. So now just work on the next part, positioning without crashing. And, you know, just stay relaxed. Don't panic. You've got the speed. You can start from 5 back. So don't have to think that you have to be second wheel and fight everyone for second wheel. Have that confidence to just try. And that's what I would tell the new guys, is just have that confidence to try and accept failure. It's going to happen. You're going to, trust me, you're going to lose more bike races than you win.
Since you retired, you've moved into coaching. You were doing a bit of coaching before, but you're quite heavily involved in that. You can hear from how your you're talking, you've got a passion, you've got an experience that you can pass on to others. How is the coaching going?
Yeah, I'm loving it. I went back to university and changed degrees, and it finished off my sport and exercise physiology degree. And now I'm doing post-grad, I'm doing advanced human nutrition. So it's just the stuff that I was interested in while I was racing, but I wasn't obviously studying it. I'm coaching the young kids now, the hub riders, the development riders here in New Zealand track cycling. The schools racing here is really, really strong up in the North Island. And so I'm started working with the Cambridge High School here. Their team's time trial practice, for example, just teaching them through and off how to stay aero, what side of the road to go, you know, just the simple things to go fast, basically what we call free speed. So no, it's really good. And I like training the kids, looking after the kids. I have, obviously, I coach a number of individual riders, you know, Tom Scully, and I used to coach Archie Bald. He's with Bora now, so they have their own coach. But a couple of pursuiters, a couple of American races. And I really enjoy that because that's the one-on-one stuff that I can get really deep down into the nitty-gritty of how we actually get them prepared well. I've just taken on a time trial specialist now for the Masters Worlds Champs in 2020. And again, it's the aerodynamics. It's all these little things that I really like as well. Plus then the nutrition side of things, the physiology side of things. So that's the ones I really sink my teeth into. But with the young kids, they're just so green and they just love to learn, you know. And I think if you can teach them the right way at a young age, okay, your pedaling technique's not perfect, mate. This is how we're going to sort out this pedaling technique. Okay, this is the crosswind here. This is where you need to be. You need to anticipate the crosswind. You need to see that what's coming, what turns next, you know. Get them to start thinking like that now. They'll think like that for their whole career, and you know, cycling will actually become a little bit easier.
These young high school kids are quite lucky to be trained by Mr. Greg Henderson, no?
Oh, I think I'm quite lucky to train them. They keep me young, mate. They keep me young and entertained.
And that's us towards the end of the podcast. Now, if you've reached this point, congratulations. I hope you've enjoyed it. Remember to rate and review the podcast. And I would just like to thank Greg for giving up his time for a fascinating chat about the art of the sprint train.
Thank you very much, mate. I really appreciate it. And yeah, we'll catch up again soon.
If you've reached this point of the podcast, congratulations. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have. Now, please remember to rate and review the podcast. And all I want to do now is thank Greg Henderson for giving up his time. Greg, it's been fascinating to chat with, in my opinion, the best lead-out man of all time. Thanks again for doing this.